kids to Snapchat. So this is all about building their brand. It's not about providing a service for kids so they can call grandma.
Josh Golan, thanks so much for being with us. We'll continue to cover this issue. Executive Director of the Campaign for Commercial-Free Childhood. And that does it for our show. We have these two breaking stories. House Speaker Paul Ryan's reportedly not going to run for re-election in November. He's leaving the House of Representatives. And this news out of Algeria. Up to 257 people have died in an Algerian military plane crash near Algiers this morning. Among the dead are reportedly 26 members of the Polisario Front, which is seeking Western Sahara's independence from Morocco. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for our paid year-long social media fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art in Portland. This concert is a collaboration of the Camas High School Choir, indie rock musician Kelly Pratt, and young audiences of Oregon and Southwest Washington. The concert is an original hour-long performance for a rock band, horns, and 200 high school singers, blending together a wide array of styles and genres. Again, that's Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art, 15 Northeast Hancock Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host a class, Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m. here at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally, nationally, and at KBOO. We'll explore how hip hop influences art, cultural, and political consciousness, and how rhyme writing, production, and liberation struggles have contributed to hip hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m., KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland.
Sing, we will sing. say. Native America, run, we will no longer succumb to oil and to ore. We will be idle no more. And we must stand for the right to be free. And we will rebuild our own society. And we will sing, we will sing, we will sing our own song. And we will teach you about the right to be free.
Good morning. Welcome once again to Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowan. That was Buffy St. Marie from her Power in the Blood CD, Sing Our Own Song. I am not Native American. I am of Italian, American, German, and Danish extraction. But my co-host, Jacqueline Keeler, who should be arriving any minute now, is a Navajo, or Diné, as they call themselves, in Dakota. And my guest on the phone from, I believe, in downtown Portland is also a Native American. She is Cherokee, and she is one of three indigenous female playwrights who are presenting their work in Oregon on Oregon's top stages. At the same time, her play is Manahatta, which is on stage at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival March 28th to all the way till October 27th. You got plenty of time to make your plans. I will talk about the others along with Mary Catherine, who's on the phone, and we'll bring her up in just a second. Hold on there, Mary Catherine. I'm going to just make a couple of announcements. Beds Not Bullets rally against police, Portland Police Bureau murder, and a resource drive today, 4 to 6 p.m. on Wednesday, April 11th, beginning at 4 p.m. Portland's Resistance will be holding a rally and resource drive for the city's houseless community. The event will take place at Portland City Hall, which, of course, is on Southwest 4th at Main, between Main and the next street up, I believe. Let's see. We will be collecting coats, tents, menstrual supplies, donations, and other supplies, which will be donated to shelters and community organizations that are actually working to help the houseless in our community. This is a response to Portland police murdering a man inside a homeless shelter on Saturday, April 7th. This follows Ted Wheeler asking the city to help him further criminalize our houseless population just one day prior. These two events are tragically tied together. What good is livability for the privileged if poor people must die to preserve it? And it goes on for the rest of the page here, but I will not read all that. You can go to their Facebook event page, Beds Not Bullets. Again, that's today, starting at 4 p.m. at Portland City Hall, downtown, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. And an event that involves my co-host, who should be showing up any minute here. Jacqueline Keeler is actually giving the which is the lecture? Sewell, I believe. She'll tell you all about it. Anyway, it's an important annual lecture that I believe sponsored by the Unitarian Church, and it is happening at the First Unitarian Church tomorrow, 7 to 9 p.m., It's titled Standing Rock to the Bundy Standoff, Occupation, Native Sovereignty, and the Fight for Sacred Landscapes. And yes, that's going on tomorrow. Doors open at 6:15. I believe it starts at 7. So it's at the First Unitarian Church, downtown 1211 Southwest Main. And then one more event. There's a important benefit for the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project. That's this Friday, 7 to 10 p.m. at the Levin Community, 5431 Northeast 20th. It's that time of year again to gather, hear some exquisite music and support the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project as they prepare for their field checking season. Come learn about their work at 11 Communities Beautiful Chapel. Eat some food, drink kombucha tea and coffee, and hear updates from the field. Presentations from the directors Karen Coulter and Paula Hood. Music from Na Rosai and Dolphin Midwives. That's this Friday, 7 to 10 p.m. at the 11 Community. And as I've been running all this down, Jacqueline Cleaver is probably making her way in the door. And sorry to keep you waiting all this time. Good morning, Mary Catherine. You still with us?
Mm-hmm, I am. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, yes, yes. I guess you were just turned down momentarily. Thank you for bearing with all that. I appreciate it. And
oh, no problem.
I really
always love listening to Buffy.
Yeah, I was actually going to say. So it looks like Jackie's on the phone because she's so late, I guess. So we'll bring her up. Are you there, Jackie? Hello, Jackie? I guess we got both my co-host and my guest on the phone. Good morning, Jacqueline.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yep, yep, yep.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Right. Yes.
Okay. All right. So this the commute is an eternal struggle we have here.
Yeah, I only live 17 minutes away, but when traffic is bad, it's really bad. So, But yeah.
Hello.
So, hello. Hi. How are you? Mary Catherine.
Good. 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 Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah. Thank you for being on the show. It was really wonderful talking to you and the other playwrights on Monday, and I'm really hoping to let more people know about all the upcoming plays going on here in the Oregon area.
Yes, it's an exciting time, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I just want to extend my gratitude. I went to two of your panel events last 3 days, and I don't know, I was very moved by y'all's passion and commitment and, you know, willingness to give of yourselves so openly and freely. So I really appreciate you taking the time to be on mine and Jacqueline's show.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for coming to our panel. You know, it's always hard when you're up there talking to truly register if what you're saying is impacting people or if you're putting people to sleep. I'm always relieved to know that people weren't sleeping and that they sounded impactful. But I think that I have every faith in the world in Delana and Larissa's plays. I just saw Delana's last night, and I knew it was phenomenal. I've seen a workshop of it, and I was absolutely blown away. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing Larissa's play tonight. So I can vouch for their plays, and I know they're both very provocative and brilliant storytellers.
Let me just, since I got all the information right here in front of me, just read that out so people get that. So Larissa Fasthorse, who's a Sikangu Lakota, her play is the Thanksgiving play, and that will be performed at Artist Repertory Theater. Started April 1st, goes till April 29th, so you don't have quite as much time to get that. And I don't actually have the address of Artist Repertory Theater. Perhaps we can get that. And then Delana Studies, who's also Cherokee, her play is And So We Walked. It's a one woman show, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And it's written and performed by her, and it's at the Armory from started March 31st and goes till May 13th. And as this Indigenous Women's Playwrights Series webpage says, it's a groundbreaking convergence of award-winning distinguished playwrights, and they three playwrights have been participating in a series of panel discussions. I believe the last one was last night. So Jacqueline, mm-hmm. Kick us off. What's your introduction or first question?
Yeah, well, I guess maybe I'd love to hear from Mary Catherine about the process of working with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and how that came to be, and describing what it's like. Have you ever staged a play there in Ashland before?
This is my first time. So it's my very first experience doing that. And I will say it's absolutely phenomenal. And, you know, it's one of the top theaters in the country, and they have such an incredible team of artists to work there. It's really, you know, it's a dream come true to be at any of these three stages that are staging Native women playwrights right now in Oregon. You know, we're very thankful. I think all three of us got started at Native theater companies, like Native Voices at the Autry in Los Angeles or Amerinda in New York. But when you have your play staged by people outside your community and with such incredible resources for a largely non-Native audience is really amazing. You know, just because of these opportunities that we haven't had them before, really, you know? So it's really incredible.
Wow. And how do they contact you? How do they find out about your work? Because you're based on the East Coast, aren't you? I mean, you're based in...
Yeah, you know, I have an agent, which is kind of crazy, because in the theater world, without an agent, not much will happen. And that's, I think, the unfortunate reality of the American theater. Most theaters are not going to read your play if you just send it to them. They want to see it as through the eyes of an agent. They want an agent to put their, you know, gatekeeper stamp of approval on it. So I'm blessed that I have an agent, and you know, but we have a lot of really talented writers who don't have agents, and then therefore, and you know, I think their work doesn't get quite as much attention as others.
So this play, Manhattan, it was, you actually, it's not, it's a play you wrote, is it one of your first plays, or that was staged, or?
It is one of my earlier plays. I actually wrote it in 2012 when I was living in Manhattan. And then it's, you know, it's just interesting how life works. I didn't, you know, no one would produce it for years. And I tried, I wrote it as a part of the Emerging Writers Group at the Public Theater in New York. And I will say a community theater did a non-equity production of it, which is why the Oregon Shakespeare Festival's production is still considered the world premiere. That's sort of a technical term that only, you know, people in theater even care about. But and that was like 3 years ago, I believe, or I think around that, that the Oklahoma City Theater Company did a production of it. And but ever since then, my agent has been sending it around to, you know, hundreds of theater companies around the country, and none of them would produce it. So, you know, again, it just goes back to just don't give up, you know, I think, as a playwright, because part of being a playwright is accepting rejection. I mean, I probably, in my lifetime, have submitted my plays to probably 2,000 times and been rejected. I mean, you can't even keep track. You can't even count. I mean, for years, I just kept sending my plays around, and no one wanted to produce them, but, you know, I kept working on them, and I never gave up, and, but yeah, to be a playwright, you have to move past the rejection.
Wow, and maybe describe a little bit about what the play is about and what inspired you to write it.
Sure, I was working at a law firm in Manhattan, and one of my dear friends, who is another theater artist, was trying to get people to write plays. They were doing the Occupy Wall Street movement. This was sort of the height, you know, it was like 2010, 2011, 2012, when Occupy Wall Street was really going and having a lot of success. And she said, you know, we really want a Native playwright to contribute. And she knew I was Native, and she said, can you contribute? And I actually said, well, you should ask someone who's Lenape, since you're, you know, on their lands. And she said, who's the Lenape? And she's a very well-intentioned white liberal person, which is actually the subject of Larissa's play, the Thanksgiving play, that everyone should go see. Oh, and I found the address for that, by the way. I'll just give it out. It's Artist Repertory Theater is at 1515 Southwest Morrison Street in Portland. But anyways, so I'm in New York, and I sort of had this moment where I realized that, you know, here I am talking to someone in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and they don't know they don't know about the Lenape. And then I asked if my friend knew that the wall, who built the wall on Wall Street? And she said, well, you know, I know there was a wall here at some point. I don't know who built it. Did the British build it? And I said, no, the Dutch built it in 1654 to keep the Lenape out of their homeland. And so kind of going through all of that, and I mean, you know, as a Native Indigenous person, as a citizen of Cherokee Nation, there are a lot of places that I go, you know, those stories exist here in Portland, but I don't know them, you know, because they've been erased, they've been silenced. I know there are Native people who know them, but I think it's our responsibility when we go to another land, especially if we're going to live there, to learn the stories of people who've been the traditional caretakers of that land. And so I thought, okay, you know, I could write a play about my Cherokee family and the fight we had to save our sovereignty and before the Trail of Tears and how we won in the Supreme Court in 1832. And I have written that play, and that play was staged in D.C. just a few months ago. But because
that
was
the play Sovereignty. That was the play Sovereignty, exactly. That was staged at the Arena Theater in D.C. Yeah.
And this is the biggest irony, is that I wrote that several years after I wrote Manhattan, but no one wanted to produce Manhattan. I wrote Sovereignty in 2015, and I wrote Manhattan in 2012. And, you know, again, like, you never know what's going to happen in life, and just keep going past the rejection, right? Like, because the Manhattan was eventually produced, and who knew that it would be produced on the West Coast? I assumed it would be a theater on the East Coast that would produce it because of that connection to Lenape in proximity.
So what drew
on the East Coast wants to touch it?
Yeah. So what drew the Oregon Shakespeare Festival to produce a film about Manhattan, the origin, the Lenape struggle there?
You know, I don't really know. I do know they've been doing a lot of equity, diversity, and inclusion work, and they've been asking themselves, who are the underrepresented voices? Who are the voices that have been silenced on the American stage, and what can we do to get them onto the stage? And I know they were very intentional about reading plays by Native playwrights and saying, you know, the first Native play they ever did, and they've been around for like over 80 years, was a play by Randy Reinholtz last year called Off the Rails. He's Choctaw, a citizen of the Choctaw Nation. And, you know, I think they really put out a call to read a bunch of Native scripts. They said, we've never done a Native play, and we need to read as many scripts as we possibly can, and then we need to program them. And to their credit, you know, they didn't just do Randy's play and say, okay, we did a Native play, we're done, which I think, you know, first of all, most theaters in the country have never produced a single Native play, right? But I think many would produce one and call it quits and feel very proud of themselves. And, you know, at this point, that's all I'm fighting for. I'm like, just give us that one production. Because I'm pretty sure, too, though, audiences, the audience reaction that I've seen to our Native plays, whether they're by Randy, Larissa, Delana, Vera Bedard up in Alaska, is that people love them. And they're very interested in our stories, and they don't see them. They're not saying, oh my gosh, that's a Native story. I'm not Native. I have no interest in that. They're saying, this is an American story that no one's allowed me to have access to, and I want access to that. And it's a powerful story, and I deserve access to that, and they're almost demanding it. And so I'm confident that once theaters start producing our plays, their audiences will be demanding more. What Oregon Shakespeare Festival has been doing is amazing because they're producing more. And now that I have a play there, I see their audience that is very receptive to it and has been so gracious and loving and accepting of our story of Manhattan.
What has been some of the comments that you've gotten from audience members, or what has the reaction been?
They've been very positive. I think people also feel a little traumatized. There's a lot of historical trauma in my play. I mean, you know, it's literally about the Dutch who showed up and started, you know, they were the first wave of genocide. Like, they were killing Lenape people and in large massacres. And so, not that we necessarily portray all those massacres on stage, but they're happening in the lives of the characters who you meet and become close to in the journey of the play. And I think people, you know, all are like also hit with the fact that this is what happened on this land, and Manhattan is such an iconic piece of land now for Americans. Like, everyone wants to go to Manhattan and see the World Trade Towers and where 9/11 happened, and go to the top of the Empire State Building, and, you know, go see the Statue of Liberty. And to know that a nation was there, existing forever, you know, and all of a sudden the Dutch showed up and massacred them all, I think is somewhat problematic for our people, which I hope it is. I hope that is problematic. I hope people have to confront that reality and ask why no one ever allowed them to know that reality until now. But they've been very open to it. No one, I kind of, you know, you worry people are going to be angry because you're taking away a sort of mythological, historical narrative that never really existed, but people seem to have a lot of ownership. I mean, I worry that it's going to be like the work you do with the mascot movement, that people are going to have sort of ownership over this false narrative and not want to give it up. But so far, I mean, at least the people that I've spoken to after the play have been very receptive to it. And maybe they folks were really angry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think what I often find interesting is whenever I go anywhere in the country, I always think about the people who were there before. It stays with me because, of course, you know, we know that there are people who were here before because of our own indigenous nations' experiences, and it's sort of puzzling to me that sometimes it seems that other Americans don't think about that very much.
Mm-hmm. I think absolutely, and I know, you know, I have to get better about everywhere I go really asking that question, because, you know, again, I've also grown up in American culture and I've been taught to never think or understand that everywhere I go is indigenous land, and at some point, you know, there was a tribal nation there. They may still exist today, they may have been totally wiped out, but regardless of that, we shouldn't honor the fact that we're on their land. And, you know, that's just not what you're taught as an American to do. And, you know, and I think that, you know, in so many instances, people are taught that Natives just don't even exist anymore. You know, all these problematic things. So, I hope this play gets done in Manhattan someday, because I think people living in Manhattan should see it.
Yeah, I think so.
I'm thinking at least off Broadway.
I hadn't realized that this was its actual world premiere at the Oregon Film Festival of your play Manhattan, I thought that you were revisiting work that you had done years earlier. I hadn't realized that this was the actual first premiere, and I think we should we're speaking to Mary Catherine Nagel. She is a Cherokee playwright. And she has a play. Her play, Manhattan, is being is at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and it's playing until what date is that?
October 27th, I believe. The end of October.
October 27th. Mm-hmm. So it gives everyone here in Portland plenty of time to drive down to Ashland to go and see it. And you said that you also get a lot of young people coming to see the play there. You know, because of course a lot of high school students and are bused down there to see the Shakespeare plays. What has that been like to share that with young people?
It's been incredible. They do get so many school children, middle school students, high school students, and I would have to say that's one of the biggest blessings of working there, is that they have a whole education department and a team of people who are full-time dedicated to bringing in students. And they've done a lot of diversity and inclusion work, so that means their students, yes, are going to see William Shakespeare plays, but they're also going to see plays by now Native playwrights, Asian playwrights, Black playwrights, Latinx playwrights, LGBTQ playwrights. I mean, it's really remarkable, the inclusion work they've done. And then these students are getting to see such a diverse array of voices, and that's, I think, not common in the United States yet, and it needs to be. So I really am thankful for all the work that the education team does at OSF.
So getting all these young people from a diverse background to come to the theater, that's unusual.
Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah. It really is.
So,
this seems like a really good match then, as far as a good place to bring out the story, particularly for, you know, most people feel like they know New York City, they know Manhattan, they think of Woody Allen or something like that, but they don't ever think of, it is really surprising they don't think of what was there before, because whenever I've gone to New York City and I've walked around, you know, the streets and stuff, I always think about what did this look like before, you know, and who were the people here, so I think it's, but I found that really, really interesting. And so you're writing about a tribe, you're Cherokee,
but you're writing about the Lenape people. What did you know about the Lenape people before you started this play?
I mean, not much, you know. Like, I knew that we had the Delaware tribe, you know, in Oklahoma, but I didn't know a whole lot about them or their homeland. And, you know,
they were also removed. They were removed from their lands in New York and Pennsylvania and moved to Oklahoma as well. The Lenape people, also called the Delaware people, after Lord Delaware. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. Well, after a white guy who, like, went up a river near where they live. You know, it's just, everyone's always like, wait, are they the Delaware or the Lenape? And I'm like, oh, Lenape is their work for themselves, and then Delaware is the, you know, anyways, every tribe, right, has that name that, that the colonizers gave you, and then the, your actual word for yourself. So, you know, there are Lenape people who are alive and well and still live on Minnehaha Island. So I did my best to talk to them, as many folks as I could. And then I also spoke, you know, there's a lot of what I would call sister tribes, that they might have a different word for. You know, they're all closely related, and they're just sort of different dialects and different regions of the same people. So, like, the Mohegan and the Stockbridge Nunsi are all very closely related to the Lenape, and even though they may not call themselves Lenape. And so I spoke to them as well. I you know, communicated with some of the folks in Canada, but never got up there to actually meet them. But there are two federally recognized tribes in Canada that are Lenape, that are folks that, you know, splinter groups that left to survive the colonial genocide and moved to what is now Canada and have nations up there. And then there are two separate federally recognized nations in Oklahoma, the Delaware tribe in Bartlesville and the Delaware Nation in Anadarko. And I worked with folks from both of those tribes. I did interviews, I did just conversations, and just spent some time with different folks, and you know, tried to learn as much as I could to write this play.
Wow. So that would be, have you had any Lenape people actually attend the play, or got any feedback?
Yes. Yeah, and so far, you know, I think what I've heard, and again, people may not like it and just not tell me, you know, which is totally possible. But so far, people have been fairly moved by it, I think, and have been, you know, it's like me watching Delaney's play last night. I just, you know, I felt like, wow, I feel like my family's on stage, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, she goes through the history of Cherokee Nation, and there's several different people in the history of Cherokee Nation that she actually talks about. And, you know, this was really, really moving. So, you know, again, I'm not Native, but I mean, I don't know why I just said I'm not Native. I'm not
Native. Like, what? Lenape.
This is being turned into of events. What? but, you know, so I can't say that people who are Lenape would feel that way watching my play, because I'm not Lenape. But as a Cherokee woman watching Delaney's play, it's emotional in a way that I, as someone who makes theater every day, I don't usually go to the theater and cry a lot, just because I'm so, it's like I know how the sausage is made. I'm so in it, you know, that I'm usually also kind of thinking about it from a more technical perspective and not as emotional. And like last night watching Delaney's play, I couldn't stop crying. I mean, it was like the moment I walked on stage. And I just think too, you know, we know that when we tell our stories, we carry our ancestors with us. When you're telling the story of your nation and other people from your nation are sitting with you, I feel like all of our ancestors come, and it's very powerful. And I was incredibly moved by her play last night.
Her play is amazing. And for folks who don't know, Delaina Studi is also a Cherokee playwright, and her play is being staged at Portland Center Stage at the Armory, and it's a one-woman show. It's about it's a play inspired by her own walk, walking the Trail of Tears with her father, and going back to North Carolina, where her family was from, and just it's amazing. She does an excellent job of not just making it like a history lesson, but but teaching, giving a lot of history, but also making Cherokee people's lives come to life, modern Cherokee people's lives and the history, and reclaiming that land that they lost, I mean, that they were removed from, which was a vast area going from North Carolina to, I think you said your family was from Georgia before they were removed.
Mm-hmm. They were living in what is now Rome, Georgia, which is, you know, her play is so powerful for so many reasons. But, you know, I thought about it because it's just funny when you think about it. It's like, oh, yeah, my dad used to throw us in a minivan on spring break and say, all right, we'd take his mother, our grandmother. He's like, you know, we're taking mom on the Trail of Tears. We're going to retrace our path. Like, we're going to go back. And my great grandfather's house is a museum in Rome, Georgia.
Oh, wow.
The house he was living in. Yeah. And her play just resonates with me on so many levels. Because, like, you know, my dad used to take us back to the house where, you know, where my grandfather lived before we, you know, were removed. And that's such a powerful experience, especially, you know, I got to go with my grandmother before she passed on. And I think there's so many of us, so many Cherokees have not been able to go home and not been able to see that original place that they come from. And I think that's a shame. And I hope that more and more people get to have that experience, because I think there is, you know, Larissa talks about it, you know, as in your blood, right? It's something in your blood memory. And I can't, you can't explain it, but when you get back, there's something that happens when you go back to the land that your grandfathers come from. And it's like this feeling of belonging and knowing where you are, even though you may have never physically in your real lifetime actually been there. And it's a powerful experience.
Wow. And you, in your play that you staged in Washington, D.C. earlier this year, Sovereignty, you go into the detail, you go into a bit about what actually happened with the removal legally. Your ancestor, your direct ancestor, actually argued before the Supreme Court in the 1830s, before the very first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Marshall. And, of course, in Indian federal law, he is famous for the Marshall Trilogy. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? And how it, what it is to combine, you're also an attorney, what it is to combine the law with playwriting and history.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a lawyer, so I think a lot about the law. And I grew up with my grandmother telling me the story of my great-great-great-grandfather, John Ridge, who was one of the first Native attorneys in the history of the United States and worked very closely with Principal Chief John Ross in 1832 to bring a case up to the Supreme Court and won. And that case was all about, did Cherokee Nation have the right to continue to exist on Cherokee lands? And, you know, the state of Georgia was arguing no. They were doing everything they could to force us out, right? They passed laws making our government illegal. They passed laws saying if you are an American citizen, you can't enter Cherokee lands without the permission of the Georgia governor.
This was the state of Georgia attacking the sovereignty of the Cherokee Nation. And and this was Cherokee versus Georgia, but, right? And the case?
That was the first one.
That was the first one.
So we kept going. We didn't give up. And the next one that we won was Worcester v. Georgia.
Oh, Worcester,
so yeah. We actually lost the first one, Cherokee Nation versus Georgia. So that's, you know, so I don't talk about that one.
Okay.
But, yeah. I mean,
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I think that, you know, Worcester v. Georgia is so powerful because that argument was literally about who gets to exercise jurisdiction over non-natives on tribal lands. And the Supreme Court said, well, of course, the tribal nation, Cherokee Nation, it's their land. And I think that was a response or an answer that Georgia didn't expect. And it's sort of the exact opposite of what the Supreme Court decided in 1978 when the Supreme Court said, okay, tribal nations can no longer exercise jurisdiction over non-Indians. And I think what's important to know is that a lot of people now know that that happened in 1978, but what they don't know is that...
That was the Oliphant case, right? That actually,
exactly.
Here in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And people don't know that that case actually overturned 180 years of precedent. They see that case as just sort of the natural reality and like what just happened naturally. And, you know, what I'm trying to impress on folks is like, no, the law was something else for 180 years. And then the Supreme Court kind of just randomly decided this out of nowhere. But there was no, before that, there really wasn't precedent to support that, except if you look at Johnson v. McIntosh, which is where the Marshall Trilogy is pretty interesting and fascinating, I think, for scholars, because in 1823, Justice Marshall wrote a decision saying we're racially inferior savages and heathens, and our nations can't claim legal title to their lands because...
And this was the Doctrine of Discovery.
Yes, the Doctrine of Discovery in McIntosh, which was an 1823 case. And then, so then you have them 9 years later completely flipping and doing the exact, you know, reaching the exact opposite conclusion. And so how did that happen? That's actually a question I'm interested in. Like, what changed? I know my great-great-great-grandfather met with him on numerous occasions. Back then, it wasn't as... now it's unethical and there's all these rules. You can't go speak to a Supreme Court justice about your case one-on-one. That's just not allowed. Back then, you know, people did it all the time. So just like we sent, Cherokee Nation sent people to talk to the King of England or the King of France or the President of the United States, we sent representatives to speak to the justices on the Supreme Court, and my grandfather was one of them. I don't know. Was it these conversations that Justice Marshall had with Native leaders that kind of flipped his perspective on tribal sovereignty? I don't know, but I do know that something happened in those 9 years, right?
So the thing is, I think it's for the audience who aren't aware that for Native American nations that pre-existed, our sovereignty pre-existed out of the United States, and I think they don't realize the extent to which we have had to basically fight these battles in courts. We've tried to use the Supreme Court as a way to get justice, to get recognition of our sovereignty, of our jurisdiction over our land. That has been a seriously a mixed bag of results. And as things stand now, you know, our sovereignty is incredibly curtailed, and leaves huge jurisdictional gaps that leave Native people, particularly Native women, vulnerable on our own lands because our nations cannot prosecute people. It would be sort of like saying that basically every American has diplomatic immunity on the reservation. Mm-hmm. You know, part of the basic power of any nation to have jurisdiction. And there's been this ongoing fight with states. States are always fighting for more power over tribal lands, right? And it's ironic because states actually occupy a lower political status than tribes do because tribes are nations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be like a province in Canada trying to reduce the sovereignty of the United States. Like, those are two different mm-hmm. levels of government. They're not even the same. But because of the nature of states, and that states represent lands that the United States is sort of taking from indigenous nations and then turning into its own lands, it represents an organizational principle that is always at odds with tribes.
Right. So, I mean, this is, like, you know, something that I feel like I try to work on in theater is impressive, you know, but I hope people who see Manhattan will realize, wait a second, this is the 1600s and Lenape are living here. So, oh, wait a second, this means that tribal nations existed before the United States existed, right? Like, the period of time we're showing in Manhattan is before anyone even conceived of the United States, right? I hope I hope folks, you know, can kind of clue into that.
Yeah, and I think you know, this whole issue of the legal status of the Cherokee Nation, which your family has been fighting for that for generations. You actually also got to work on a case that went before the Supreme Court.
Yes, I got to work on Dollar General. My law firm filed an amicus brief on behalf of the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center and over 100 other Native and non-Native organizations that are working to end domestic violence and sexual assault. And that was a case where Dollar General was arguing one of their employees had sexually assaulted a non-Indian child on tribal lands, on Mississippi Choctaw land, and on their reservation, on federal trust land. So, like, you know, even as a lawyer, we always have to ask these obnoxious questions that are created by a framework created by the Supreme Court and Congress. So it's like, you know, to understand who has jurisdiction over a crime on tribal lands, you have to understand, is the victim Native or non-Native? Is the perpetrator Native or non-Native? Is the land in fee? Is it trust land? Is it who owns it? You know, what's the status of the land? And so after you answer all of those questions, then you know who has criminal jurisdiction. Civil jurisdiction is very different. The Supreme Court hasn't decided an Oliphant case in terms of our civil jurisdiction. The Supreme Court hasn't taken away our jurisdiction. Dollar General asked them to do that. Dollar General literally said to the Supreme Court, you took away their criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians in 1978. Now you should take away their civil. They shouldn't have it.
And so this is a corporation now also challenging the sovereignty, not criminal sovereignty, but basic civil sovereignty, jurisdictional sovereignty of an indigenous nation.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable that a corporation is saying all of this, right? Like, it's just, yeah, it's disturbing.
Yeah, well, I often point out I give this whole lecture about how the United States is still a colony, but the fact is that all the original colonies, many of them started out as early corporations, as joint stock companies. And so this relationship between, you know, the governmental powers of colonial governments and corporations goes back to the very origins of this country, back to Jamestown, you know, which was, of course, you know, funded by the Virginia Company of Adventurers in London, who were given governmental powers by the crown. When they arrived, you know, they were given the right to do that when they arrived here by the English crown. And so it's it goes back to the very earliest origins of this country, but it's almost coming full circle, you know.
The Dutch West India Company was a corporation, which I think, you know, a lot of people don't realize. And it's so interesting. I mean, the character who plays the leader of the Dutch West India Company then plays the CEO of Lehman in the present day.
Oh, yeah. Well, explain how those
so
two stories. Yeah. So both of these plays in Manhattan and in Sovereignty, there are reflections, like dual stories, one that deals with history and one deals with the present. And you kind of maybe explain a little bit how that, why you do that, and how it helps explain how it helps with the to bring across the points you want to bring across.
Sure. So all the actors play someone in the past and someone in the present. They go back and forth in time, really, and they sometimes change on stage, but the point is that people see the actors embodying both. Is my goal is for them to see that. And you know, Jane Snake, who's our modern day, you know, hero that we follow, she, you know, the actress who plays her plays Jane Snake and then also plays one of her ancestors from before. And, you know, there's a reason for that. I'm trying to make that connection and show people, you know, we bring our ancestors with us. We're, you know, we follow in their footsteps.
Jane Snake is a young professional Native woman, Lenape woman,
mm-hmm.
is living and working in Manhattan. Like you were also a young professional. So
let me, I just need to break in here. This is Paul Rowland. I'm really enjoying this conversation with my co-host Jacqueline Keeler, who's on the phone, stuck in traffic apparently. And our guest, Mary Catherine Nagel, who, as you've been hearing, is a Cherokee playwright. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives takes you to Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week lecture series to hear from legendary activist Ralph Nader. At 10, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15 is always Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. 11, The Dirtbag tackles the soil dilemma, to till or not to till, plus your gardening questions. And thanks, as always, to our KBOO members for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member, or go to How to Get Involved to get involved in other ways. So I just want to, you're talking about your, Jacqueline, your talk on sovereignty. I just want to mention once again, which you haven't talked about, tomorrow you're giving a talk at the Sewell, annual Sewell lecture at the First Unitarian Church. 7 to 9 p.m. That's 1211 Southwest Main Street. We only have about 6-7 minutes left, so I don't know if you'll have time to say more about that. Anyway, it's called Standing Rock to the Bundy Standoff. And you also are involved in this thing on Saturday, also at the Unitarian Church at the Elliott Center there, from 9 to 12, Frontline Communities on Environmental and Climate Justice, Just Transition, and other groups. And I don't know if you want to talk about either or both of those really quickly.
I've been really honored to be asked to deliver this year's Sewell lecture and at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. And I will be talking about the topic of my next book, actually, which is comparing the Bundy takeovers to Standing Rock. I covered the Bundy takeover of Malheur as a journalist in January and February of 2016, and then I also covered the Standing Rock standoff between the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Great Sioux Nation, the Ocheti Shakowin, and so I'm comparing the two. I sort of call it sovereign citizen versus sovereign nation, and really looking at the strengths and weaknesses of particularly the Bundy arguments to this whole sovereign citizen, idea of county supremacy. They actually think the sheriff is the most powerful person in the world, and versus sovereign nation, which, as Mary Catherine Nagel has been pointing out, Native nations have very strong legal arguments supporting, particularly through treaties, which are only entered into by sovereign nations, that right now their sovereignty is being suppressed. And so the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, as a member of the Great Sioux Nation, it definitely has a right to invoke the treaty, the Fort Laramie treaties, in the mildest terms possible, which is just consultation. And I feel that the response by the state of North Dakota, the incredibly militarized response, makes the occupation of our lands visible, because certainly that area north of the reservation is unceded treaty land under the Fort Laramie treaties, and the United States occupies it solely through military force in violation of international law. And so comparing those two is really what I'm going to be looking at. And then on Saturday, I'm moderating another panel, and so I'm really excited to talk about climate justice for marginalized communities.
And again, that's Frontline Communities on Environmental and Climate Justice, Saturday, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. at the Elliott Center at the First Unitarian Church. And I will attempt to get those events added to my program page at kbo.fm. Wednesday Talk Radio. We only have about 5 minutes left. If you all want to continue, let me just get it all in one sentence here, so we can get that out of the way. That your play, Mary Catherine Nagel, is Manahatta, is on stage at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival down in Ashland, March until October 27th. Larissa Fasthorse Lopez's play, the Thanksgiving play, will be at the Artist Repertory Theater until April 29th. And So We Walked, written and performed by Delana Studi, is at the Armory until May 13th. Go ahead and wrap it up, ladies.
Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add, Mary Catherine?
Gosh, I'm trying to think. I can't think of anything else except, I mean, I'll just say for those of you in Portland, you know, get out and see Larissa and Delana's plays. They're powerful. They're wonderful. I'm actually seeing Larissa's tonight, but I saw Delana's last night, and I've read Larissa's play, and I know her work, and I know it's just an incredible opportunity that folks have here to see both of these plays in the same city at the same time.
This is pretty rare, isn't it? I mean, I don't think that
this
has actually ever happened before in any major city in the United States, where three Native women's plays are playwrights are being performed, you know, in at the same time.
Right. I mean, you know, again, most theaters in the United States have never produced a single play by a Native playwright. and we have three theaters in Oregon that are doing that, when most theaters in the country have yet to even do that. So it is really that exciting. At least that's the level of excitement that we all have.
Yeah, it was great having you, all three of you together. And I think that panel that we did on Monday with Larissa and Delana and yourself, and with me moderating, I think that will be on State of Wonder, which is another radio show, but through OPB. Yeah, so that will be. So if you folks want to hear more from everyone about what happened, that will be on there. And I'll try to link to it on my blog. And Diosh by now. So, I think, it was really great talking to you. And I'm looking forward to taking a trip down to Ashland to see your play. And I know that when your play was in D.C., a lot of my friends went to see it, and they were just raving about it. They really loved it. I'm really excited to see Manhattan.
Yay! Well, I can't wait to hear what you think of it.
Yeah, and Delana's
please let
play
me know.
Is amazing. And so we walked here at Portland Center Stage, and I really, it's a long play. There is intermission, but it is really worth it. It was just a really, I loved where she went with everything, and I still need to see Larissa's play, and I'm going to get out there and see that as well. And she's done a lot of outreach in the community as well. A lot of events.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we've got to wrap
up. I'm excited to hear. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary
thank
Catherine.
You.
And thank you, Jacqueline. And stay tuned to more programming here on KBOO Community Radio. Up next will be Political Perspectives and Ralph Nader.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bright Moments, with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art in Portland. This concert is a collaboration of the Camas High School Choir, indie rock musician Kelly Pratt, and young audiences of Oregon and Southwest Washington. The concert is an original hour-long performance for a rock band, horns, and 200 high school singers, blending together a wide array of styles and genres. Again, that's Bright Moments with the Camas High School Choir on Friday, April 13th at 6:30 p.m. at the Portland Institute of Contemporary Art, 15 Northeast Hancock Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host a class, Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It, with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m. here at KBOO in Portland. This class will explore hip hop history locally, nationally, and at KBOO. We'll explore how hip hop influences art, culture, and political consciousness, and how rhyme writing, production, and liberation struggles have contributed to hip hop culture. Again, that's Hip Hop Past, Present, and Future, and Your Place in It with Mike Crenshaw, Saturday, April 16th at 4 p.m., KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9 o'clock. Stay tuned now for Political Perspectives. We go to Sonoma State University's Social Justice Week lecture series to hear from legendary activist Ralph Nader.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we play you a recent speech given by American political activist, author, lecturer, and attorney, Ralph Nader. His topic, One Person Can Make a Difference, Social Justice and World Affairs. Stay tuned for an hour-long talk by Ralph Nader on the Project Censored Show. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On March 5th, 2018, iconic activist Ralph Nader keynoted the